goal of Premananda Hare. All glories, ye assembled devotees. All glories, ye assembled devotees. All glories, ye assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Okay, so, Omagana Tumidanda Shaganjana Shilakaya Chakshura Meditam Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha. So, the topic of this evening's presentation is controversial questions and controversial answers. Instead of perfect questions, perfect answers, like controversial questions, controversial answers. And the only restriction is there shouldn't be any questions that are offensive towards any Vaishnava. That's the important thing. I mean, you can present doubts, that's fine, but nothing that criticizes any Vaishnava devotee of the Lord. How's that? Okay, so are you the only one who's going to ask questions?
These are all the questions from the devotees.
From the devotees, okay. Okay, so Devirata is going to ask questions and get me upset, and then then I'm going to yell at him. So anyway, so ask the questions.
Okay. Actually, before we start the more controversial part of the program, we would first like to ask you a more constructive question concerning our duty to Srila Prabhupada and ISKCON. The question is connected to the lecture of Srila Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj given in Mayapur in 1997, entitled Protecting Srila Prabhupada's House. In this lecture, Maharaj is saying how Srila Prabhupada's house, or ISKCON, is under attack by various legal court cases, various organized groups.
Mm-hmm.
He says it is being attacked literally by power destruction demons, by riptic philosophy and similar. He continues and says, be what it may, this house is Prabhupada's house, and it is our duty to protect it. Our question to you, Maharaj, is how do we do it? Especially those of us who don't have any special position in ISKCON. How can we help protect Srila Prabhupada's house?
That's a very easy question to answer. Actually, Srila Prabhupada said that we cannot be hurt from any forces from the outside. We can only be hurt from our own disagreements or fighting or whatever inside. So if we're unified and determined to remain in Prabhupada's society, and Prabhupada said there will be so many discrepancies in ISKCON. I mean, this is the material world, and Prabhupada said ISKCON is like a hospital. People are getting better, that, you know, still a little bit sick or pretty sick. Like if you go in a hospital, people are sick, but they're getting better. So you come to ISKCON, people are still sick with a material disease, unless they're pure devotees, but they're getting better. So there are going to be so many discrepancies, but you don't leave. Another example Prabhupada gave is that when the boat is rocking, you don't jump off thinking you're going to be safe. You stay on the boat. So if we work together and don't criticize each other and develop loving relationships with each other, then our move will be extremely attractive to everybody. And as Prabhupada said, or actually it's a quote from Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, let the jackals howl, the caravan will pass. So that's the best way. No politics amongst the devotees. Just like we all join hands and chant Kumbaya. You heard that before? Kumbaya, you know. And nobody can hurt us. There'll be an invisible shield. There used to be an advertisement for a toothpaste when I was young. And it showed someone throwing a very hard ball or a rock at someone else. And they said, because you have this invisible shield, you won't get any cavities. You know what a cavity is? Cavity means when the teeth get holes in them or something. And so it showed, they threw the rock and the rock just boom, bounced off. So that's the point. If we're strong in our own sadhana, if we're strong with our relationships, nobody could hurt us. And nobody could hurt our society. There will be so many attacks, and these attacks actually make us stronger. I mean, just like we've had some legal cases, but then what I discovered is when the legal cases occur, the devotees join together more and unifies the movement more, and they take it as a stepping stone or as a positive step to work together more. Isn't it? So when, and actually, even in politics, if you have a common enemy, it sort of unifies everybody. That's one of the political strategies. So, all right, now get to something real controversial, more interesting.
Srila Prabhupada would oftentimes use the phrase bhakti cult.
Yeah.
In the outside world, there are many definitions of what a religious cult is, and there are too many to cover. One such example is from the American Family Foundation, who expound the concept by listing 40 characteristics, among them such as group being preoccupied by bringing in new members, questioning, doubting, and dissent are discouraged or even punished. The use of mind-numbing techniques such as meditation, chanting, speaking in tongues, denunciation sessions, debilitating work routines, are used to suppress doubts about the group and its leaders. The group, the next one is the group being elitist, claiming a special...
Elitist.
Claiming a special exalted status for itself, its leaders and members. For example, the leader is considered a messiah or an avatar. The group and or the leader has a special mission to save humanity.
Yeah.
The group teaches or implies that its supposedly exalted ends justify means that members would have considered unethical before joining the group, for example, collecting money for bogus charities. It seems that these descriptions fit like a glove. Are we religious cult?
Well, first of all, let's try to understand what the word cult means. If you go look in the dictionary, cult can mean any group of people who have a common set of beliefs. But usually it's used in what we call a pejorative way or a critical way when you say something is a cult. So this American Family Foundation has given certain definitions that may even apply to the Army or the Navy. So we have to see which ones are actually harmful and which ones are useful. I mean, because any organization, they have to have a sense of identity. You know, insiders and outsiders, you know, whether it's the Army, whether it's a member of the government, or anything, any sort of, you know, the doctors' association. So there has to be a sense of self-identification. So that's not necessarily bad. However, what's bad is when you denigrate and look down upon others as evil or demons or something like that. And that's been a problem in every religious society. I would say, you know, you look at the Muslim religion. Not all of them, of course, but, you know, a lot of them consider everyone else to be a kafir, infidel. I remember I was brought up in the Jewish religion. We considered everybody else to be useless. It wasn't a man. We're like, we were the chosen people. You know, you ever heard this expression before? The Jewish people think they're chosen. And if you didn't have a Jewish mother, that's the only way you could be Jewish, is if you had a Jewish mother. Even if your father was Jewish, you were also useless, unless your mother was also. Because it's a matriarchal line. So you'll find that in immature expressions of every religion. It doesn't negate the religion, it's just a criticism of the immature followers or a group of immature people in a particular religion. So in any religion, you'll find people that fall under some of these negative characteristics. Some of them are actually not negative, they're actually positive. Like, for example, we do have more knowledge. It's the postgraduate study of the science of God, as Srila Prabhupada said. We don't claim, I mean, any intelligent, open-minded devotee is not going to claim that we have an exclusive right to knowledge. Bhaktivinoda Thakur states, for example, that one goes to other religious practices and say they're worshiping the same Shama, that's Krishna, as we are, and we appreciate it. And I sometimes go to different religious ceremonies, and we have interreligious dialogues in Fiji. I established a whole thing, and we appreciate each other. So that's a mature participant in a religion. However, one of the things that happens when you start a new religion, people tend to be fanatic. I mean, I certainly was fanatic when I joined the Hare Krishna movement in many ways, which I'm not going to describe now. But that's a symptom of young people. It's not a criticism of the religion per se. It's a symptom of young people, fanatic people, or less educated people, as you'll see anywhere in the world. I mean, even in Serbia, you go and the Serbian Orthodox Church is dedicating themselves like hours a day on the television to criticizing every other religion, including Hare Krishna, other than themselves. So there's a certain immature element in any religious group. And unfortunately, we also have an immature element, and I'm not making excuses for that. And sometimes we've had people in our movement who have been cult leaders, you know, just demand blind following of their followers. And many times we have people who are just like open and, you know, just normal people in our Christian consciousness. You know, we have a mixture. I mean, you're not going to condemn the Catholic Church because there's so many priests who've been child abusers, or there have been so many abuses in the Catholic Church. I mean, there are sincere religious people, and it's not a statement about the Catholic religion. So anyway, so this American Family Foundation is right about certain members of our religion, certain members of every religion. They can have that pejorative definition of cult. So we should learn from that particular statement that we should be more open, understanding, loving, not looking down upon everybody else, understanding the philosophy, not following blindly. So these are all lessons for us to learn, because that's how Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu presented it. I mean, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he made Muslims devotees. I mean, his main person who preached the holy names, Haridas Thakur, was considered an outcast in society. So Lord Chaitanya was definitely the most democratic preacher of God consciousness, and we're supposed to follow in his footsteps, all right? Another controversial, not so controversial.
Srila Prabhupada would oftentimes use the phrase Vaishnava sect in relation to our Sampradaya.
Yes.
But in the ordinary everyday use of the word, we can sense a pejorative connotation to the word sect.
Yes.
When looking in the outside sources, there are many definitions of what a sect is, too many to cover. But one of the more interesting scientific definitions we can find is made by the English sociologist Roy Wallace, who argues that the sect is characterized by epistemological authoritarianism. He says that a sect possesses some authoritative locus for the legitimate attribution of heresy. According to him, sects claim to possess unique and privileged access to the truth of salvation, and their committed adherents typically regard all those outside the confines of the collectivity as in error. Again, it seems that the description fits like a glove. So are we a sect?
Well, Prabhupada's use of the word sect, of course, meant a group of people. Because Prabhupada wasn't that familiar with the modern dictionary or the common usage of the word sect. So that takes care of the first part of the question. But, you know, as far as epistemology, that, yes, we do claim to have some special, you know, descending knowledge coming from Krishna. And there's nothing wrong with it. Because unless you claim to have some special knowledge coming from Krishna, then your understanding is dependent on everybody's subjective viewpoint. And then not only do you not have a sect at that point, but you don't even have a group of people believing in the same thing. I mean, you got to have some unity. And unity in the Krishna Conscious Movement is based upon loving relationship with Krishna and also a consistent philosophy. So you do need some epistemological basis. I mean, we one of the first ways I deal with people when I'm talking to them is I ask them, how do you know what you know? You know, and then I explain the Vedic literatures, the epistemology, the descending process coming down from God. And probably every religion has that, you know, the holy scriptures. Of course, some of them get a little messed up with their epistemology because they have the holy scriptures, and then they take every single theologian who comments on them later on as being absolute. I mean, for example, in the Christian religion, they don't primarily follow Jesus Christ. They follow Paul, who never even met Jesus Christ. I mean, he's like their authority par excellence. So, you know, Paul said so many things that differed with Jesus Christ and differed from the apostles. But still, he's accepted, you know, as the authority. So they're accepting the authority. But we have a claim, and which does make us different. You know, we're not saying we're the same as that. We have a claim that we're accepting authority. This is our hermeneutics, based upon agreement. You know, when the guru is speaking, if he's speaking on the absolute platform, he has to be speaking based on agreement with the shastras. He's not just like a cult leader or something like that. It makes up his own philosophy. Like there were cult leaders from India, so many of them. There was one from Korea who claimed himself to be the modern incarnation of Jesus Christ. There was someone from India who claimed that his disciples should buy him a Rolls Royce for every day of the year. I mean, there's so many people like that. But we have these checks and balances that really keeps us from being a dangerous sect or a dangerous cult. And those checks and balances are Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu, where these other organizations don't really have that check and balance. So that really makes us much more, let us say, open, well-balanced, broad-minded, and also protected. Because you have a right, and everyone has a right, if the Guru says something, to ask, you know, where's that in the Shastra? Or you have a right to ask the Sadhu, you know, my Guru said we could smoke marijuana, so is that right? You know, or whatever. So that actually protects us from the dangerous sect. There's nothing wrong with being a sect, being a group of people believing in the same thing, but being a dangerous sect is a different thing. You know, blind following. So, yeah. So what's wrong with me to say?
In Srimad Bhagavatam, another Srila Prabhupada's book, we can read how in Vedic times the freedom of speech was so highly developed that a common citizen could
approach
publicly
the king.
Expose the faults in the king's administration in front of the king without losing his head for it or being exiled. It appears that Srila Prabhupada also wanted to implement this high culture of freedom of doubt and dialectical discussion within ISKCON.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it seems that nowadays bureaucracy and authoritarian culture of our institution are greatly overshadowing such rabbinical legacy to be developed. Freedom of speech is oftentimes repressed, but the content is considered controversial or offensive by those in the administrative positions. What to do?
Go to America. Isn't it? I don't find that in America so much. It's just that, I mean, it's also, if you find such a situation in a particular locale, that is, you know, the fault or just the doings of the local people. And, I mean, I don't find that in most places in America that the temples are like that. I find it maybe to a fault to the opposite extreme, that people will say any damn thing and get away with it, even if it's offensive. I mean, there has to be, like, freedom of speech really needs to have some limits to it, because if you harm someone or offend someone, let's say if I have freedom of speech, let's say if I go into a movie theater, this is a typical example given, and I yell out fire when there's no fire. You know, I have the freedom to say that. And there's a stampede for the door and several people are hurt. Then I can get arrested for exercising my freedom of the speech. So there's certain times you got to be a little careful with speech, not to offend people. Certainly you could express things, you express your doubts and everything like that. But if you go up to the, let's say, temple president and say, you know, I think you're a demon, you know, it's offensive. You shouldn't be doing that. And he has a right to punch you in the mouth. No, so he has a right. he has a right to discipline you, I mean, at that point. Because, it's, you know, there has to be Vaishnava behavior, you know, manners. Everything has to be done with the right manners. And, yeah, in certain places, in any institution, I mean, even in the army, you don't have freedom of speech. I mean, I remember basic training. If you even smile, you have to do push-ups. You know, while the sergeant is telling you, do this, don't smile, officer. You know, okay, 100 push-ups for you, you know. So sometimes in discipline, there's a little curtailment of absolute freedom of speech. But I don't really find that even here in Slovenia. I mean, it's such authoritarian structure. You know, I find the governments are worse than that. You know, there's supposed to be freedom of movement, but when I come to Europe, I have to show my passport. If I come to the temple, I never have to show my passport. So, I mean, just don't be offensive. But in any case, I mean, it just depends on the circumstance. Like, we're people. And if you go to a situation where someone becomes too authoritative, that's the fault of the situation, not the fault of the movement. If you've got a large movement, you're going to find all sorts of things. It's like that song from the 1960s, Alice's Restaurant. Anyone hear that song? It goes, "You can get anything you want." That's Arlo Guthrie song. Some of you who are older would remember that song, "At Alice's Restaurant." Anyway, so which means, you know, you can find almost anything in our movement. You'll find people who are too authoritative. You'll find people who are not authoritative enough. I mean, for example, in Fiji, where I preach, they're used to a very authoritative regime because the previous GVC was Tumal Krishnamurti, who was very authoritative. So I arrive there, and they say, "Maharaj, you got to yell at us more." And one time, just one class, I just, gave them real sauce. And they said, "Wow, that was wonderful." And I said, "If I do that all the time, I'll have a heart attack. So please don't ask me to do it." Sometimes people want that or need that or are accustomed to that. And sometimes people can't do it like me. So it's just different situations. I mean, our movement is very, very open. You got to do a lot to get kicked out of the Hare Krishna movement. I don't even know how. Isn't it? I mean, just like we say, you know, everyone should wear a dhoti, but how many people are wearing dhotis here? Isn't it? How many ladies are wearing saris? How many, you know, who's wearing tilak? Some people are not even wearing tilak. I mean, so how disciplined are we? You say with discipline, I don't think so. It's like a hippie edition, new hippie edition, you know. You know, we're supposed to have like bald heads. Women are all supposed to have their hair tied back in a sika. And so, but who's doing it so? And why am I getting heavy about it? Right? So that means that we're not so disciplined. If we all were uniform dress, you know, all nice pressed dhotis and saris, and all the ladies had their heads covered like this, then I start to wonder about it. But I remember one temple was like that. This is one temple many years ago, the temple president made all the ladies have their like that, like this. Almost like burkas. So that's a temple's problem. That's not ISKCON's problem. It takes all kinds to make a world. So, all right, another question?
The next question is a controversial topic that seems will never be put to rest, the fall of the jiva. The first book on this topic was written by Satya Narayana and Kundalini Dasa.
Who don't accept Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. The Guru or Bhakti Vinod Thakur, so I don't accept them.
Anyway.
So, I mean, we have our epistemology. I mean,
it was dedicated.
They don't accept that Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was properly initiated by Guru Prashodas Babaji Maharaj. What kind of authority are they? And anyway, ISKCON has published their book, and I've read Bhaktivinoda Thakur's books, and it's pretty evident that we were originally in the spiritual world. What we were doing, you can reconcile all these things too. Because they say, well, the soul came from the Tathashta. Well, the soul, first of all, there's no such place as Tathashta. But the soul did come from the Mahavishnu, from the glance of the Mahavishnu at the creation, time of the creation, because we were resting after the last dissolution. So you can reconcile both explanations. Anyway, and some things are just a chincha. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, anadi karma karana pale, that no one can trace out the fall of the jiva. And even when you start to talk about the jiva falling down, there's a time thing there, but there's no time in the spiritual world, so how do you figure all that out? You know, it's basically, in one sense, inconceivable. And Prabhupada, he usually responded to that question, was that, you know, if someone falls into the ocean, usually you don't ask how I got here. Usually you ask, how can I get the hell out of here? So for me, you know, wherever I came from, I came from. But I'm here. And I want to go back to Krishna Loka. So people make a big deal of that subject matter, basically because they want to criticize. They find a point in which they can criticize, because a variety of emotional needs they have, let's say. Behind every philosophical position, you will find a psychological state of mind. So I think even the Rifiks, you know, obviously you're going to ask some question about Rifiks later on. But what is their psychological state of mind? I'm not so interested in the philosophy because it's just not the Siddhanta. And Prabhupada never would change the Siddhanta. But why are they doing what they're doing? Why are they going on the internet and spending so much energy? Why don't they just do their own thing? If they're right about Rifikism, why don't they just do their own thing? Why do they have to publish a magazine that says Back to Godhead, Back to Prabhupada that criticizes every Vaishnava who's doing dramatic preaching? So there's some psychology, there's some anger, frustration, or something behind it. Because when I have a different opinion with someone, I don't spend my life talking about them. I said, you know, Hare Krishna, that's it. You know, I have differences of opinion with people all the time. But I just, you know, it doesn't change my life. I'll do what I want to do. But they're concentrated. They make it their number one issue because they have issues. So examine their psychology first. Then you can understand philosophy. And you can never defeat someone on the basis of philosophy. Because in Kali Yuga especially, it doesn't work. Because they're not philosophical, they're psychological. Maybe their mother didn't treat them properly. I don't know. So, next question.
Many devotees are noticing or are under the impression that the divorce rate in ISKCON is very high. To some of us, it seems it is even higher than the outside world,
yes,
generally speaking.
Yes.
What would you say are the main reasons behind this phenomenon, especially considering the fact that our philosophy and Srila Prabhupada's general instructions in this context are opposing the very concept of divorce clearly? And also, since in the very culture the man can have many wives, who is getting the reactions for the divorce, and what are the reactions for the divorcing?
I think we should just give everybody sannyas, then there's no problem with divorce. So seriously, yes, I think there may be a higher percentage of people getting divorced in the Krishna conscious movement. And the reason being, at least that's my analysis, is that we have such a great philosophy that we tend to be rather judgmental and a lot up in our heads and not enough in the heart. And, you know, there's certain aspects of the philosophy, when misused, can keep us from being, let us say, loving with other people. And I'm not speaking in a sexual way necessarily, but just like having an open heart and having loving relationships, you know, or being compassionate or empathic, because we're just up there in the head judging all the time. And you know, there's a lot of statements in the Shastras decrying the attraction between men and women. So naturally someone gets married and they think, oh, that she's Maya Devi or something. And the brahmacharis are all making fun of you for getting married. So, and you're seeing things philosophically and not taking enough time in the relationship to understand each other, not being determined in understanding the importance of keeping a marriage together. People who are prematurely taking the spiritual life can become very selfish, and that's one of the tendencies of people who think that they're actually more advanced than they actually are. It's increasing selfishness. You know, or the desire for one's own pleasure or liberation or something like that. All these things can lead to divorce. Or another point is like getting married without really adequately examining who you're getting married to. I mean, there were many arrangements made in our movement where they said, you're a man, she's a woman, okay. Your sacrifice is tomorrow. And then maybe because the person was a brahmachari or brahmacharini for so long, anything looks good to them. You understand the point? I mean, just like if you haven't eaten for 3 weeks and someone can bring out some sauerkraut like I eat every day, it's like, wow. So they don't take the time to consider important things like compatibility, which in the Vedic system were actually done extensively with horoscopes and things like that. So there's many different reasons, but I think you're perhaps right about the divorce rate being very high. And you know, the other reasons might be that many of the devotees were not responsible members of society before, were hippies, basically, and weren't taught a sense of responsibility. Like one time Prabhupada said about brahmachari, he said brahmachari means dirty. Not that he wanted it like that, but he was just like perceiving that's how the brahmacharis were in the Krishna consciousness movement. Not you, all of you, of course, but because the people that became devotees in the beginning were hippie group. You understand? Or nowadays, I think it's becoming a little bit different. You're getting more professional people who have education. But in those days, you know, basically if someone was coming down from an LSD trip, you shoved him in the temple and shaved his hair off, and the next morning he was in Mangalarti, chanting 16 rounds. And, you know, such a person may not be the best candidate for being responsible in household life or in any other ashram, for that matter of fact. So there's a variety of reasons, and I'm not making excuses for the high divorce rate in the movement, but basically people should be willing to work it out. You know, they expect everything to be romantic. What do they say? The honeymoon is over after a certain period of time, like a few months. And they expect like that romance, but that sort of romanticism only occurs permanently with Krishna, not with another jiva soul. So people have to work on it. And people, also devotees are sometimes reluctant to take the help from so-called, quote, material authorities. You know, when sometimes I've suggested to devotees, maybe you should go to a marriage counselor. That's Maya. So they get divorced. It doesn't even make sense. You know, I said, go to a marriage counselor. Because the marriage counselor is expert in marriage, you know, disputes. Or I even give this book to devotees sometimes, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Anyone, you've heard that book before? And they said, that's a Maya book. I'm just going to read the Bhagavatam. So then they read the Bhagavatam about, you know, some story like Paramjana. And that doesn't help their marriage. Right? Or Pururava and Urvasi. And all these different stories like that. You know, Paramjana becomes a woman in his next life, and the man saying, I don't want to become a woman in my next life. And then so they don't really take help from the proper people who can help them. You know, usually I do suggest marriage counseling if people need that. And devotees are very reluctant. So there's a variety of reasons, yes. But I think as our movement matures, the people will also mature, and we'll have devotee marriage counselors, we'll have devotee doctors and psychologists. We certainly have psychiatrists and doctor devotees. You know, it's just a reluctance to accept help from the outside. I mean, I've seen people with schizophrenia, and the temple president will just say, just chant Hare Krishna, you'll get better. And the person will chant, Hare Krishna, oh, I see Krishna. Krishna's talking to me. And finally they run out of the temple, you know, in the middle of the winter without any clothes on, and just, oh, they didn't chant purely enough. So, anyway. So we do have to take advantage of material help, you know, when necessary, because it's a material thing, psychology and all those other things, and we mean it. It's not just because we're a devotee, temple president, or guru that we're expert in all the different fields. You know, I'm not expert in all these different fields. I'm expert in some fields, but not all of them. Sometimes it's that tendency, I'm spiritually advanced, I know what's best. You know, I'm expert in the Ayurveda. You broke your leg, here's a herb. I see things like that. you know, many people who have had diseases and they go to Ayurvedic doctors and they die, and many people with those same diseases, they go to Western doctors and they live. So, you know, you got to be practical in this world. It's not that Ayurveda is any less Maya than Western doctors. So, what's the next controversial point? You can't go on forever, of course.
After the publication of the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, many devotees left the movement. Many devotees still have trouble accepting Srila Prabhupada's words on how we have never landed on the moon, since there are video recordings of astronauts walking on the moon available to the general public. The same goes for his statement that the sun is rotating around the earth, which is opposing the empirical observations of modern astronomy.
So, first of all, Prabhupada said both things. He said, even if they did go to the moon, we talked about this the other day, that one has to be able to distinguish between the spiritual master speaking from the absolute or the relative platform. That's called hermeneutics. You know, Prabhupada did give his opinion sometimes, and that wasn't an absolute statement. I mean, for example, there's a funny story that one time Brahmananda, and I told you the story, Brahmananda Prabhu told Srila Prabhupada, he said, I have an Indian girlfriend. And then Prabhupada said, let me see her picture. And he pulls out the picture and Prabhupada says, she's not so good looking. And Brahmananda lost all interest in her after that. following the order of the spiritual master. You know, had Prabhupada said she's gorgeous, he would have just got married to her. But anyway, so... But that's a relative statement, you know. You know, so we have to be able to distinguish. I mean, Prabhupada made statements like, you know, women's brain substance versus men's brain substance. And it's a relative statement. So Prabhupada said that he heard it from his professor Urquhart in the Scottish Church's college. So that's part of understanding how to deal with a spiritual master and not accepting things blindly. So, but Prabhupada did say both things. He said, even if they went, what did they get? You know, that's another thing Prabhupada said. And as far as the sun revolving around the moon, Sariputta Prabhu explains this very nicely in his the sun revolving around the earth. That, and even I understood this before, that movements can be explained from different perspectives. Of course, it's a much more complicated movement to have the sun revolving around the earth. But still, it can be explained mathematically that way. Sariputta does that. And he also explains the differences in the distances. Like Prabhupada one time said, the sun is closer to the earth than the moon. And then he explains it, Sariputta explains it, that the sun is closer to the earth in terms of what we call the ecliptic. And I don't want to get into all these technical descriptions, but there's ways to actually explain these things so it works. And Sariputta actually showed how the distances explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam and the other Vedic literatures were pretty much consistent with the distances in the same scale as those that have been discovered by the astronomers. So, I mean, you have to read Sariputta's books. He was very expert. Unfortunately, we lost him. He left his body. But he was very expert in reconciling what Prabhupada said with others. And also, you have books like, of course, he was an expert in information theory, which is the mathematical theory of understanding how much information is required to, let's say, for a cell to develop or some organ in the body to develop. And he was able to show using mathematics that evolution is impossible. Did you ever read this book? Yeah, what's the name of that book he wrote? It's called Mechanistic and Non-Mechanistic Science. Has anyone read that book? No one here has read that book. Anyway, you started, yeah. But it's a little too heavy for you to read. It is. I mean, I understood it because that's my background. My background was in advanced mathematics, multidimensional mathematics and physics. So for me, that's like enjoyable. But for most devotees, oh, what's going on here? Probability of 10 to the minus 10 billion? What does that mean? You know, but anyway, he was able to explain those things. These things can be reconciled. And as far as the descriptions of the hells of the fifth canto, you know, there's already hell on earth. I mean, if you go some places on the earth, Let's say what some people are subjected to, the punishments or tortures that some people are subjected to, just like this Boko Haram people, how they're torturing people is far worse practically, or maybe on the same level as what you read the Yamadutta is doing. So the world isn't just like a nice place with everybody just loving each other. There's hellish things going on now. And then you have to ask the question, why do some people suffer those things? And the only explanation is karma. It's unfortunate. It's not that we become uncompassionate because we have the karmic explanation. But at the same time, we understand that everything moves because of the will of the Lord. Any other questions?
How do we understand Srila Prabhupada's apparent managerial mistakes, like putting Kirtananda Maharaj in high positions of authority?
Exactly what I said before. These things are not absolute. Prabhupada was trying his best. Prabhupada is not Krishna, he's not omniscient. The pure devotee is never described that a pure devotee is omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent, like that. He tries different things, like Prabhupada tried different things, giving young people sannyas, which in most cases didn't work. Prabhupada tried the Gurukul system, it didn't work. Prabhupada had 11 years on the planet before he left this world. So he was really trying a whole bunch of different things and try to spread Krishna. And he was successful. He was successful, but some things just didn't work. And that's not taken away from Prabhupada's position, because everything he did was to please Krishna and please his spiritual master. But it's not that if you're driving in the car with the spiritual master and he turns the wrong way, that he's making a serious spiritual mistake, and you lose doubt, you lose faith in him. I mean, can you imagine losing faith? I mean, just because of some relative thing, you lose faith in the spiritual master. We have the wrong concept of what a spiritual master is. That's the real problem. You know, we see the spiritual master as Superman. You know, he can, fly over tall buildings like a speeding bullet or something. And, you know, even Prabhupada sometimes would be quoting different Sanskrit verses, and he would quote them in a different way. Well, I'm not saying wrong, but, you know, he would quote differently than it's there in the Shastras. Because you don't expect material perfection, even in a pure devotee. His perfection is he loves Krishna 100%. And he's guiding you to come back to Krishna. But, you know, Prabhupada made decisions. Sometimes tomorrow Krishna Maharaj would present an opposite viewpoint, and Prabhupada would change his decision. Prabhupada was a person. He wasn't a superhuman machine. So, next question.
Some are saying that Srila Prabhupada, he's an Nitya Siddha and Shakti Vishavata from the spiritual world. But after being displeased with his wife, he wanted another, more beautiful wife. They say he was seriously considering it. Is this true?
Yeah, I mean, if your wife won't let you preach, you should look for another one. It's not that he wanted another wife because he wanted someone more beautiful. He said his wife was actually attractive, but she was interfering with his preaching. I mean, that's common sense. If you're living with, I'm not saying people should take two wives, all right? Gotta be careful. So, if you're living with someone who just like is nasty to you all day long, you're definitely going to, Prabhupada's a person. You're definitely going to be thinking of different alternatives. And at that time, two wives was not prohibited. It was actually a common thing. I actually have a friend from India who founded our movement in Fiji. His name is Vasudev. He has two wives. And they're both sisters. Lord Nityananda had two wives. Polygamy, I'm not advocating polygamy. I think it's a bad idea in Kali Yuga. So I don't want to get any of the women angry. I think it's a horrible idea in Kali Yuga, but it's already been practiced by everybody because they're doing serial polygamy. Serial polygamy means one after the other, and they're not taking care of them. I mean, I think it's more honest, rather than to keep dumping one woman, off as you get a new one, to take care of whoever you married in the first place. I mean, that's more honest than divorce and remarriage. Even though, Western sensibility doesn't accept it, but it's actually more honest. Because you're not throwing someone away. West, in the West, you throw someone away. Of course, they can sue you for money and everything like that. Nowadays, people don't even get married. That's even worse. Because then as soon as there's some trouble, you just say, hasta la vista. Isn't it? Yeah, instead, they have this fancy word now, just partner, instead of wife or husband. I'd like you to meet my partner of the week. So Prabhupada, he was fitting in with what was socially acceptable then, and he wanted someone to help him preach. Or help him be just like, or just be submissive, or not even submissive, just like nice to him. You know, it's kind of stressful to have someone talking back to you 24 hours a day. Isn't it? So I don't find any fault in that. And then Prabhupada's father said, no. He said, this one wife is great for you. Because in this way you won't be attached. And Prabhupada thought, and Prabhupada being an obedient son followed his father's instructions. But he wasn't doing anything adharmic. Because it was just part of the culture. I mean, look at Arjuna. How many wives did Arjuna have? And Chitraketu had 10 million. That's a lot, isn't it? That's like 5 times the population of Slovenia. But in any case, our philosophy is one life, one wife. You just stick it out. I mean, sometimes things happen. I'm not condemning anyone for, you know, because sometimes things happen. It's just people or dangerous situation or abuse. I mean, there's so many things. It's Kali Yuga, so you really can't expect that sort of perfection. So, next question.
In his diary, Harishari Prabhu gives a comment about Srila Prabhupada taking some tobacco.
Yeah.
And if you have trouble understanding this, how would you explain it?
Medicine. All the herbs can be used as medicine. For example, if someone has terminal cancer, you know the best pain reliever they can take? What? Marijuana. But if you take it, get out of here. But if someone has terminal cancer, I won't condemn someone for it. I won't give it to them because it's illegal. Of course, in the United States, some places it's legal. And they've really gotten too far with it. They have clinics at every corner. Oh, I have a headache. And then the doctor's there, and they say, all right, marijuana, which, and they have like 25 different strains you can buy. Would you like Acapulco Gold? It's gotten like that. I'm serious. You can see it in the news. This is not a joke. I mean, they have all these different bottles, like an apothecary shop, you know. So that's a little too far out. But, you know, Prabhupada had migraine headaches. And normally for migraine headaches, people take different medicines. Let's see, what's that medicine? Sumatriptan succinate, that's the main migraine medicine that people take. It's called Imitrix. Anyone here take it? Imitrix, sumatriptan succinate. Anyway, so that's the main medicine. And it's harmful to the body. So if snuff is going to help. Or give an example of garlic, right? We don't eat garlic, do we? No, because it smells bad. People ask me, why don't we eat garlic? And I said, the only people I let eat garlic are brahmacharis, because that way no one will marry them. You know, as soon as he goes near the woman, he goes, So, no, but seriously, let's say garlic is prohibited. Okay. Garlic, I get in trouble for telling too many jokes. But anyway, garlic is prohibited, but it's also the best broad spectrum antibiotic and antiviral. So we had one case in Premanosa's story. We had one of our ladies, she had this MRSA, which is like a resistant superbug, that it was in her thumb and it was gradually moving up the arm to the rest of the body. And the doctors were trying their best. What can we do to get rid? You know, they even had operations, all antibiotics, nothing was working. So the doctor said, all right, come to the hospital next week. We're probably going to have to cut your arm off. And I said to her, okay, here's some garlic. Eat it like an apple. That's even nasty. So she began to eat the garlic like an apple, and 2 days later, the infection was gone. Doctors won't tell you about it because they can't make money prescribing garlic. I'm not saying that I'm a doctor, but it worked for her. So there's certain things that are prohibited under certain circumstances that in other circumstances, you know, someone has terminal cancer. They're not a drug addict. You're just trying to help them live the rest of their lives. I mean, even my godbrothers who left their bodies, like Bhakti Tirthamars and others, they were taking like morphine and things like that. Because you don't want to have a peaceful mind to hear the heart. You don't get intoxicated. But you want to have a peaceful mind to chant. I mean, if all the time you're just screaming in pain, you don't know what it's like. I mean, I don't either in this life. To have some like extreme pain, like from cancer. When I went to see Bhakti Tirthamars, you know, I was talking to him and I went to like embrace him. And he said, don't touch me. And I said, why not? He said, because if you touch me, you may break my the ribs. Because the cancer had eaten away at the ribs. You can't imagine how painful that situation is. So obviously you need a pain reliever. So what's prohibited in one circumstance is all right in another circumstance. In fact, every herb has a medicinal use. Prabhupada actually said that. There's a medicinal use. That's why Krishna has placed these herbs here for us. So there's nothing wrong with Prabhupada taking snuff. But if you take snuff, don't. Don't. You know, and all sorts of different medicines have different effects like that. So, next question.
Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote in his autobiography how he liked eating meat and fish and had a hard time from refraining from doing so.
Yes.
He also writes that he had this diet all up until he was initiated in the age of 42.
Yes.
Many devotees, when hearing about this, they wonder how can a Amrita Siddha, a Shakti Vaishnava from the spiritual world, have such a problem and as a result doubt his status of being from the spiritual world.
Well, in the pastimes of Nityasiddha devotees, we find that in many cases they act like ordinary conditioned souls until they come in contact with the Guru, until they take up Krishna consciousness, it teaches a lesson. Even we have Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of course he never ate meat or anything, but he would be harassing the Vaishnavas. The Vaishnavas would run away when they would see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and they would pray to Krishna that he would become a devotee. They say, please let Nimai Panda become a devotee, because if he becomes a devotee, he'll be a great preacher, because before he was preaching Krishna consciousness, he used to preach Nyaya, that means logic and everything, and defeat the Vaishnavas. He would challenge them and give them a hard time. And so when he took initiation, he changed completely. So in the same way, these great devotees are showing that when you take shelter of a guru, then your life changes. So there's many reasons for that particular pastime. And also many kshatriyas in the old days, they would eat meat too. So, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur's family, he's called a devotee, was born in a, there was many members of his family weren't devotees. You know, Daicha, Kulera, something like that. I forget the exact Bengali. He was born in a family of Daichas. I mean, so. I mean, and also you don't look at someone's past. That's called the naked mother philosophy. Nadrika Mata philosophy, that you think because your mother was naked when she was young, then therefore you should, she should always remain so, or you should think of her like that. You know, people change. And even pure devotees, they have pastimes. They act like ordinary people. So,
Followers of Srila Narayan Maharaj say that Srila Prabhupada asked Srila Narayan Maharaj to take care of his disciples. For example, Narayan Maharaj himself declared in Mirvilumbar, Australia, how he stated, "I am the real successor of Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, and there is no other. you should know this very openly. I am a Bhaktivedanta and he is Bhaktivedanta, but he received this name after I did. I am similar to him in this regard. I am Bhaktivedanta and I am also ISKCON. Don't think that I am not, that I am out of ISKCON. How do we understand this and what is our official relationship with this group? Is there a dialogue or cooperation with this kind of group?
First of all, I'm not going to criticize them. I think what he said speaks for itself. There's one thing. If I ask someone to, let's say if I say someone to help my disciples, let's say, you know, I ask some, let's say Ananda's here, and I say, please, you know, after I'm not here, please help my disciples. And then he comes and says, I'm the successor to your Guru Maharaj. I think it's quite different. It's quite a different thing. But I, based on what he said, I think his words themselves indicate a certain political mood, which I'm not going to comment on, too, because it would mean criticizing him. And we do have dialogues with his organization right now. And even the head pujari in Krishna Balaram Mandir is initiated by Narayan Maharaj. So, you know, we're open. People ask us, you know, why do we sometimes prohibit people from different mosques coming? We're not really doing that. We only prohibit people from different mosques that would be political who are trying to convince us that we should leave ISKCON because they're the actual Bhaktivedanta. Or, you know, they're the actual follower of Prabhupada, or they can give us something that Prabhupada didn't have time to give us. We only react politically when someone else is political with us. You understand? Just like we had one follower of Narayan Maharaj in our temple in North Carolina. His name was Ram Dass. You remember Ram Dass. And he was also a disciple of Prabhupada. So I allowed him to come to the temple. But then he started taking down the names and addresses of all the people at our Sunday feast. And then I said, you know, you're doing that for a purpose. You can't come anymore. So if someone acts like a gentleman, you know, they come to your house, there's etiquette how they should act, then it's fine. I mean, we can have followers of this Maharaj, that Maharaj, even Guru Maharaji, or it doesn't matter. We're not, you know, why should we be sectarian like that? But it's a question of politics. If someone's going to attack us, then we have to take a defensive stance. But, I mean, I think what you just read speaks for itself as far as his attitude. I don't have to defeat that because it's just extremely obvious. Just like if I said, you know, or if I said I'm Prabhupada's successor or something like that. Yeah, go on.
One of the issues that were raised even in documentaries is the absence of parents in the lives of their children. Yeah. During Prabhupada's presence in the movement, while the parents were preaching around the world, the children were left in Gurukul with total strangers.
Yeah.
Oftentimes were not even qualified to raise them. How do we understand this historical fact properly?
Well, Prabhupada was going by a tradition in India. Even Lord Ramchandra, when he was young, was sent to the Gurukula, away from his parents. And Prabhupada expected more from us. You know, unfortunately, because we were primarily in the mode of passion, that the people we put taking care of the Gurukula were those who couldn't go on Sankirtan, who couldn't do deity worship, who couldn't do anything else. And it was our mistake. You know, Prabhupada expected more from us. We didn't live up to Prabhupada's expectations. It's not that the Gurukul system was necessarily bad, because that was the tradition in India. The people would go and stay. And usually the Gurukul teachers would be like surrogate parents. They'd be like a couple, a man and his wife, and they'd be very loving with the children. And it wasn't the case in the Gurukul. And, you know, Prabhupada was innocent in many ways that, just like many of us were. I mean, I never heard about child abuse before I joined the Krishna Consciousness Movement. I never even knew that there was something that existed like that. And I think 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, practically nobody knew about these things either. But it was going on. I mean, I'm sure in the whole world it was going on. I mean, just like in the Catholic Church, in one diocese, they had 30 priests who were child abusers, in the Diocese of Boston, Massachusetts. So, you know, we're learning about these things, and sometimes we're just not aware, or we're a little naive about these things, and Prabhupada wasn't aware of that, but the system is not necessarily a bad system. It was done out of Prabhupada's concern for the children if they had a Krishna conscious education. Prabhupada used to call the non-devotee schools slaughterhouses. And, you know, if ever I am born in the Krishna conscious movement, which might not be a bad idea, I would hope my parents would send me to a devotee school. I mean, not a gurukul where I would stay away from the parents, but I hope that I would be trained in Krishna consciousness in that way, or homeschooled. Some of our very good devotees, they were homeschooled too. And that's a very successful formula, at least in the United States. Yeah, so that's what happened. You know, unfortunately, we didn't live up to Prabhupada's expectations. So, next one.
Many devotees are wondering how such great and empowered devotees as Bhagavan, Hare Krishna, etc. have fallen. What would you say are the main reasons for gurus falling in ISKCON, and what are the main qualities that protect a devotee from falling?
Okay, so one of the things the Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur talks about is the process of bhakti can be the cause of some anarthas. And as anarthas come from dhanam, janam, and sundarim, you understand? Wealth, followers, and, you know, women, or whatever. So one has to be extremely careful when one takes a position, especially when one is getting worship, people praise you, you begin to think that it's true after a while. Now, I often give the example, as a guru, every year you get to have a book written about yourself. It's pretty nice, isn't it? You can imagine, you get a book written, big, thick book, how nice you are, with pictures of you smiling, some pictures of your lotus feet, and if some devotee happens to discover your baby pictures, you know, if your mother sends the baby pictures, they put those in the book too. And, you know, as a baby you were crawling, they say, oh, here he is offering obeisances. And if the baby is drooling, oh, it's a symptom of Vyabhachari Bhava, you know, drooling from the mouth. So it can go to your head after a while. You know, people bathe your feet wherever you go. They feed you whatever you want. So people can get bewildered, yes, by all that. And then they begin to think they're a guru. And Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, if you think you're a guru, you're a guru, like you're a cow or an ass. So instead of thinking that they're servants, and that's really what happened. These were sincere devotees. You know, practically everyone was sincere. Bhagavan, very sincere devotee, but they just became overcome by the anarthas. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says anarthas come from different sources, and one of the sources is bhakti itself. And Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says at the same time where we're cultivating the devotional creeper, weeds may grow. So one has to be very careful about those weeds. It requires a lot of attention. So one should just think, I'm a servant, Gopi Bharata Padakamala Dasa 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 Dasa. And that I'm no better than anyone else, it's just that, you know, Krishna's given me the service of sitting here. And then one is protected at that point. It's hard, you know, reading books about yourself is just ecstatic. I don't know. I was never attracted to it. I don't think I've ever done a selfie with my cell phone yet. You know, now you know what a selfie is? That's the latest thing where you're just like... Some devotees did that with me today. They wanted to have a picture of themselves with me, so they went like that. So, I don't know, it gets a little tiring after a while. Getting your feet bathed and getting someone to offer RT to you. I mean, maybe the first time you see your picture on the altar, it's a little exciting. They're singing my name. Like that. But, you know, after a while, you know. After a while, you just want to chant Hare Krishna and be happy, like everyone else. So that's why. So another question? We don't have much longer.
It seems that times have changed since the time when Srila Prabhupada was present on earth and taught us to push the book distribution.
Yes.
How effective can our book distribution tactic be, considering that nowadays people generally don't read books anymore? They usually don't have time. Mostly people search for their information on the internet. They spend most of their free time on social media like Facebook, YouTube, and they watch TV. For example, our Slovenian Yatra has so far distributed over 600,000 books in a country with less than 2 million people, but there are not that many devotees. Should we continue to have book distribution as our main and oftentimes only preaching tactic, or is it time to change the preaching strategy according to time, place, and circumstance?
Okay, when you say there's not many devotees, I think we have more devotees per capita in this temple, in this yatra, than any country in the world. Per capita means per population, you understand? There's 2 million people in Slovenia. How many devotees do we have? I mean, not just initiated devotees, but followers, people who accept Krishna as God. I mean, does anyone have an estimate?
I heard about 200.
No, 100?
200.
No, I would say several thousand, at least in this country. People who accept Krishna as God. I'm not talking about initiated devotees. And even initiated devotees, you probably have at least 300 or 400 in this country, but... You know, people accept Krishna as God, people become vegetarians because of our movement. People change their outlook, people read Prabhupada's books. You probably have many more than you can possibly imagine. And then the book itself, is as far as people not reading books anymore, I don't really think that that's a fact so much. I mean, I still read books. And I think everybody in this room, you all still read books. It's just that, you know, books have been de-emphasized. And nowadays when people read books, in many cases they read in these e-readers, like the Kindles and everything, but it's still the reading. People still like reading. And then when people go on the internet and they read something, they become more attracted to reading Prabhupada's books because they read an excerpt from Prabhupada's books. And when people even respect the book, even if they don't read it, they put it on their shelf, they make spiritual advancement. Or people give a donation. When you distribute a book, they make spiritual advancement. So, I mean, obviously we should explore different avenues of preaching at the same time as we distribute Prabhupada's books. I mean, there's internet, you know, we use Facebook, we use Mayapur TV, let's see, probably a lot of people watching now. Let's see how many people watching while we're talking about it. Give me a second. No, only 14. Terrible. All right, so. Anyway, so there is, we should use every available opportunity, radio, TV, internet, on the street, prasadam distribution, and we're being very successful. I find this, not only in numbers, one of the most successful yatra, but also in quality. You know, the quality of devotees, you know, really nice service attitude. And there's hardly any politics here. I mean, maybe it's a little tiny or something like that. But, you know, the devotees like each other. They like to serve and they take care. There was a devotee who passed away. They're all taking care of the devotee. It's nice. I mean, I come all the way to Europe just to come here. And I go back. This is my vacation, my Christmas vacation. After the Christmas marathon. I come here. So if you think it hasn't been successful, you are wrong. It's been very successful here. I mean, in the last few years, I mean, most of these devotees are newer to them. Some of them are old, a little older, but most of them are newer. When I first came here, it was in 1998, 1999, there was just me and two devotees in the temple with no heat. It was just, you know, me and Dhamma Krishna and Kavi Karnapur. And that was it. And the whole, all these buildings here, and there was a proposal to sell all the buildings because, you know, you couldn't maintain the buildings with just two people. And all they could afford to do was heat the building for 2 hours because they had to buy this much gas in a little gas container. While I was here, they were running back and forth to the store by gas containers. And I don't even remember who cooked for me. I may have cooked for myself when I first came here. But I told the devotees, we're not going to sell the temple. I said, you'll have to kill me. That was my statement to them. Because they said, we have to sell, we can't maintain. I said, no, you're going to kill me first. Because I was a GBC. So he said, you're not, then when I die, yeah, but not now. And so we kept the temple, and a lot, so many people came after that. I mean, most of the devotees here came after that point. Just because of that, you know, keeping the temple. And then we have wonderful temple president, Ananta. He was very educated. PhD temple president, pretty good, isn't it? Wow. That's amazing, a PhD temple president. Wow, I'm impressed. Anyway, and then, you know, so many devotees, educated devotees, so it's successful. If it keeps expanding at the present rate, and how many sanghas do we have, and how many of these Wisdom of the East programs do we have? And in all these cities, like Selvi, you have so many devotees. This country has less than one quarter of the amount of people in the state that I'm in the United States, and we don't have one tenth the amount of devotees. In the state that I'm in, we have over 8 million people in North Carolina. That's a lot, isn't it? I mean, this would be considered a small city, the whole country. And yet, how many devotees we have? You know, I get envious when I come here. So the book distribution is working. It just takes time for the seed to sprout. Yeah, next question. It's almost time to end.
The Rifiks are very active in preaching their philosophy and criticizing our gurus all over the internet. Sometimes you think it is almost impossible to successfully avoid their many internet sites,
yes,
Facebook pages and YouTube videos. If one writes the name of practically any ISKCON sannyasi, usually the top results one gets are Rifik sites. As a result, many young new generation devotees get infected by their philosophy and criticism of ISKCON and start doubting or even lose faith. Not to mention that the very people we are distributing books to are getting the wrong impression because of the sites as well. Why is our presence on the internet weaker, even though we are much greater in numbers? Why is ISKCON not fighting their influence on the internet?
We haven't put up enough. We haven't paid enough attention to the internet. Yeah, that's true. And actually, what they do, I mean, if you know enough about the internet, you actually pay to have first position or second position or third position or high up on the search engine. Isn't it true? Prema knows about that because she was a hypnotist. She is a hypnotist. She used to hypnotize Google. You know, anyway, she would pay to get a higher position on the internet. And ISKCON has not paid any attention to this. And unfortunately, you know, the first thing you see on the internet are negative sites, about not only about gurus, but about Hare Krishna or whatever. And we have to do more. That's true. But as I said before, this indicates their psychological state. You know, why spend so much energy? Do something positive. You know, if you don't like ISKCON's system of gurus, then do something positive. Who's going to stop you? It's a free world. But instead, the people who criticize ISKCON, they don't do anything positive. It's all negative. You know, make your own movement. Initiate people on Prabhupada's behalf if you want. I mean, who's going to stop you? But they don't. They're trying to disturb the faith of people, which is actually not proper. It's not proper manners. Yeah. Next question.
There are so many rumors online about ISKCON sannyasis supposedly doing mistakes, scandalous things. Such malicious gossip is mostly promoted by the Rifiks, but sometimes even by our own members of the society.
Yeah.
Most current gossip example is that Sachinandana Maharaj...
Oh, wait, no personal things.
Okay. Just skip this one.
You don't have to skip the whole thing, but just don't give the example of...
Oh, okay. Such Rifik gossip is sometimes almost impossible to avoid when using Google search. So how do we understand such writings, and what can we do after being exposed to such gossip and having our minds disturbed?
Well, like I said, ISKCON should arrange that positive stuff on the internet. And even there's gossip about Bhaktivinoda Thakur and other acharyas too. There was a nasty thing about Bhaktivinoda Thakur about a month ago that was circulating on the internet. Because people really like bad news. Good news is no news. I mean, if you go on any of these regular news sites like CNN or anything like that, and you look at people's comments after the news report, and it's always nasty stuff. So what we can do is just work on the internet. I mean, there's always going to be rumors about things. I mean, you can find things about me, about any sannyasi, anybody who's done anything. You'll find rumors about it. And you just, you know, and if there's any doubt, you can ask the person. Or ask another GBC man, you know, is it a true rumor? You know, did Krishna Maharaj go hang gliding the other day? You know, whatever. I mean, just ask them. Just don't accept blindly what's on the internet. Okay.
There are many rumors about ISKCON sannyasis being rich, having personal bank accounts.
That would be nice.
Big sums of Lakshmi, with big sums of Lakshmi donated to...
Tell me who. I want to talk to them.
It's a rumor. On the other hand, there are many ISKCON temples and devotees who are poor. So some devotees are claiming that. They're claiming that...
ISKCON sannyasis are rich. I mean, some of them have inherited money from their family. I know one particular sannyasi has asked, and that, you know, that's Hare Krishna. And on the other hand, every sannyasi, guru, and GBC member has to submit a yearly financial report. And that report has to deal with all the money that they have. And some sannyasis are given quite a bit of money, but it turns out that they turn it all over to the ISKCON temples for something. I know when people give me something, then I use it for traveling. It all gets put in the ISKCON account. I don't have any personal account. And I use it, but I use that particular money for traveling, and most of the money goes to the temple, actually. Right now I'm paying the mortgage on a house that's owned by a temple that's used as an ashram facility. And then people right now want me to pay for this new Krishna West Center, which has a high rent every month. And then you get the GBC, every time you go to a GBC meeting, they go around the room, who can give money for this, who can give money for that. I'm afraid to go to GBC meetings. So whatever you get, it goes out to ISKCON. I don't find the sannyasis hoarding money, and in general, it's not a large amount of money. I mean, I could certainly have made a lot more before I joined the Krishna Conscious Movement had I just continued my education or gone to work for my father. And it's not mine anyway. It's all ISKCON. I have no personal savings. I mean, I'm an example of what generally is there for all the sannyasis. You know, and in fact, I just had to apply for government money in the United States, you know, because I'm 65, retirement money. Called Social Security, so see if the government can help me a little bit. Anyway, so it's not that we have these super rich. I mean, I don't know any sannyasi who's super rich, and basically, I don't know any sannyasi who keeps money. If people give money, they spend it on a project. I mean, like I have this Govardhan project. And so, you know, people give money for that project. You know, so we have projects, too, that people give money for. But in any case, it's all reported to the GBC. And the GBC body is well aware of it. It's not as big a thing as you would think it is. You know, I don't see any sannyasis with Rolls Royces. It's a rumor. And it all goes to the temples anyway. You know, whatever anyone has. And what are they going to buy? I mean, how many chapatis can a sannyasi eat? how many beds can he sleep in? You know, so what does he need? So, any other questions?
Huh?
How do we know Chaitanya wasn't doing God just like Jesus was by his followers later on, after his disappearance?
What? No, Chaitanya was accepted as God during his appearance. I mean, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had his Mahaprakasha Lila. He exhibited himself as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He showed the universal form. I mean, so many things he did. He did amazing things. Not just miracles like curing the leper Vasudeva, but he actually demonstrated that he was God. So it's not like Lord Jesus Christ, that he became God. Actually, there's an interesting book. It's called When Jesus Became God. And because there were two divisions of Christianity after Jesus Christ left the planet. And it's called the Arian controversy. There was Athanasius and Arius. I mean, it's a little bit of technical history for you. And one side said that Jesus was God, the other side Jesus wasn't God. And they had fights. They were burning each other's churches down. And the side that won was the side that said Jesus is God. So that's, if you're interested, this is an interesting book in Christian history called the When Jesus Became God. You can look it up on the internet, amazon.com. Okay? So one more question, it's getting late.
Some academics argument that post-factum predictions of Lord Buddha's appearance and of the spread of Advaita philosophy of Shankara are similar preaching tactics as it was used also by the Christians to convert pagans, by implementing some of the pagan rituals, icons, and practices, like the Christmas tree and the Easter eggs, to convert them.
Yeah.
These scholars claim, for example, that Lord Buddha is mentioned as a post-factum prediction to fool the Buddhists to accept the Vaishnava philosophy, fooling them to think the scriptures are older and as such are validating themselves with the prediction of Buddha's and Shankara's appearance. This accusation of preaching tactics sounds similar to the factual preaching tactic used in the book Hari Bhakti Vilas, written by Srila Sanatana Goswami to preach to the smarter Brahmanas.
Hmm. Well, as far as the history of the Vedic literature is concerned, the Sir Henry James was the first Indologist, and he came to the conclusion, there's a reason I'm telling this history, he came to the conclusion, and he stated this openly, that the language of Sanskrit was more precise and exacting and more philosophical and further advanced than either Greek or Latin. And when he made that statement, there was a massive uproar in Europe, that's here, not here, just here, but there's a massive uproar, and they decided they had to find some way to decry the Vedic literatures. And so they established at Cambridge and Oxford departments of Sanskrit literature that were paid for by Christians and people against the Vedic literatures, and different scholars, especially German scholars like Max Müller, were hired to try to disprove the authenticity of the Vedic literatures, even though linguistically Sanskrit is far more advanced. And they came up with different theories. You know, one of the theories, of course, is this Aryan invasion theory. That means that the reason people in India were so advanced is because we, the Europeans, came and invaded them, and we made the mistake of marrying some of them. And those, you know, in other words, they mixed. We, the Europeans. I can say I'm also European because of a European background and my family. And that's why they're so advanced, but actually they're just aborigines. Or in the words of Rudyard Kipling, the white man's burden. You've heard that statement before. You know, it's our burden to civilize them, because they could not accept that the Vedic literatures were that old. But if we examine things scientifically, for example, the Vedic literature described what's called a civilization along the Saraswati River. And the Saraswati River is, you can't see the Saraswati River now. It's really not in existence. But when the scientists sent up their satellites, they were able to perceive where the ancient riverbed was. And then analyzing the material where the riverbed was, they discovered that that river was there 4,000 years ago and disappeared 4,000 years ago. And that way, they could actually begin to date the Vedic civilization. Because after that point, nobody would have written about that. So they could date it. And there's other methods of dating, too, that have been used by devotees or people favorable to the Vedic civilization. One is the astrological descriptions given in the Mahabharata about the Mahabharata war, how they fit in scientifically with what was happening in the stars at that time. And the scientists, they really don't have any definitive means of dating the Vedic literature, so they come up with all these accusations. Incidentally, the Buddha described in the Srimad Bhagavatam is not the Buddha of 2,000 years ago. The Prabhupada said that's a different Buddha, just so you know, so you don't use that particular incident to prove things. So they have this thing called Glatu chronology. You've heard of Glatu chronology before? No. Here's some new information for you. Glatu chronology means you can define how old a language is by how much it has changed in a certain amount of time. In other words, all languages change. Like if you look at William Shakespeare, everyone's heard of William Shakespeare? His English is completely different than the English I spoke, or I'm speaking now. I mean, you can hardly understand some of the words, and they mean different things. So the glatto chronology thesis was that language changes at a constant rate. So therefore, you can tell the difference between that Sanskrit and this Sanskrit by how old the Sanskrit is. But then that theory was proven wrong. For example, in certain European languages, I think it's Latvian, the language hasn't changed at all in 1,000 years. So you have certain instances where it doesn't change, language doesn't change, certain instances where it changes dramatically over a short period of time. So that theory was thrown in the garbage. So they've had no method, scientific method, other than the methods I spoke about before, where you can try to date in a valid way the Vedic literatures. All right? I think we have to end now. Is that enough controversy?
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm actually starting to get tired. And I have to leave tomorrow morning. You'll all be relieved of me tomorrow. When the cat's away and the mice will play. So thank you very much for your attention. Thank you very much for your hospitality, everybody, during this night's visit to Slovenia. And I'll be back in May. And we may be doing a health seminar at that particular point, you know. And the name of my health seminar is Stop Killing the Devotees. And I've given it in many places around the world. And, you know, even here in the Balkans, you know, I was giving it at the summer camps. But so we may do it at that time, and Mukunda Prabhu may be arranging for the European Union to pay for me to do it. It's pretty good, isn't it? Pay for me to chant Hare Krishna. Then I'll chant more enthusiastically. Okay, on that happy note, all glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Hey, what happened? It shut down. The computer shut down.
Thank you.